Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady or the inventor of the hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size and self-love and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine of thepaleomom.com. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
We'll just pretend like we haven't been talking for half an hour already.
Okay, but I have to repeat that I did Ariel this evening.
Have you gone
onto Instagram and seen the video yet while we were talking about all the other things?
No, so I have to repeat that my very first question was, what is Ariel?
And did you learn? What is it? Tell our listeners.
It's Cirque du Soleil with clothes on.
Right?
Which is totally not how you described it to me. But... that was the visual that I got. Oh my gosh. You are so beautiful. You are so graceful.
Yeah. No, I don't think graceful would be the word that I would use, but thank you. But I really want one. It is definitely core work, and it feels really great to be to transition in and out of weightlessness and then to hold up your own strength and I really loved playing with it. So I'm going to see.
Is this in a studio?
Yes. I went with Viv to her pole studio because Viv, who I co-host Strong Women Radio with, does pole at least once a week. And they have what they call fly. And today was like an open gym for them kind of thing. And so I went and played with the fly.
So I'm having the same reaction that 17% of our listeners are having of open gym pole. wait, it's just making my brain.
Such a prude, as many people know, because I don't like to talk about poop. I'm the same way with anything intimate about one's person. So you can imagine my level of awkward when I walked in to the pole studio and I'm wearing knee-high boots, long pants with a skirt over top, with a tank top and a shirt over top and a scarf. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready. And all of them are in their underwear.
Right. I was going to say that made the word overdressed and just took it to the next level.
Yep. Yep. But, they felt comfortable. I felt comfortable.
There was no judgment. We were good.
Yep.
So I have to say hello and virtual hugs to you from a bajillion people.
Oh,
signing
from Texas, all the Texans.
I lost track of how many people said, I love your podcast. You and Stacey are the best. I had one person say, I heard you on another podcast, which I won't actually repeat on our podcast because I don't think that's nice. And I started listening to the Paleo View and stopped listening to the other.
Oh my goodness.
So that's why I'm not saying which other podcast that was. I'll tell you privately later. So I was like, that's a pretty fun story and I'll take it. Thank you. We had a couple more male listeners come and say hello, which I always love.
I think we're probably in the 20s by now.
Easily. 27 maybe.
We're just kidding. We know that there's more of you out there, guys.
So I think it's our version of Rob Wolf's 6 listener joke.
Yes. Yes.
So, male listeners, now we got 27. It's good. Yeah. When you've got a good joke, why move on? So
when the joke is so old that you realize like it's so stale and you can't recover, you just try to make it fresh again by repeating over and over.
Yes. Yes. Well, it was funny the first time.
Yeah.
Got to be funny the 7,623rd time.
Well,
right?
The first time it probably wasn't a joke. The first time we were probably serious.
Six more listeners. Yes. Yes, that is what happened. but I just want to thank everyone who came out in Austin and Houston. They were really wonderful events. It was my first time in Houston. And can I say something? Best huggers are in Houston.
Everything's bigger.
Best huggers. I could not believe the high proportion of like really good, tight squeeze, just amazing hugs in Houston. And I was impressed. And because when you bring me presents, I say your name on the podcast. Special thank you to Pam, who brought me a little bag with a beautiful tea towel in it and some wonderful like AIP snack foods. Obviously somebody who knows what I like to eat. And obviously trolls my Instagram account because it was like all my faves in a bag that I got to enjoy as a contributor to my picnic dinner on the way to the airport. Mm. So I was super appreciative of that. So
I still remember like vividly the broth in New York City and the pot roast and those plantain crackers in Chicago, which I can't believe I haven't made because they're your recipe. And they were like, they were exactly what I needed in that moment. The Chicago trip was like so insane. So I can imagine that you were appreciative.
It was also such a crazy trip because I flew out first thing Friday morning and then, had a working lunch. Carissa, who's my chief operations officer, lives in Austin. So she took me out to get my hair blown out, which was lovely, and made my suitcase so much lighter to not have to think about what I'm going to do with my hair. and then we had an AIP dinner at Vox Table, which was amazing. The chef did. We just gave him a list of here's what we can't eat. Please make us something. And he made us this like 4-course dinner that was phenomenal. And so that was like all of the local Austin AIP bloggers. It was phenomenal. And then straight to the signing. And then it was like midnight all of a sudden, central time. And I'm used to Eastern time. I'm like, this. And then I had to get up early to hit picnic on the drive to Houston. And then went from the book signing to the airport to fly home to land at 11 p.m. and have a very harrowing drive home. I actually was the car immediately behind a 4-car wreck on the highway on the connector. So if people are familiar with Atlanta, the connector is like at that point, it's 6 lanes in either direction. And I was just really lucky that I had enough stopping distance because I slammed on the brakes and screeched to a halt and was about 10 feet shy of the 2 cars that were in the worst shape were immediately in front of me and they were both totaled. I don't think anybody was seriously injured. There was one guy who definitely was going to go get looked at. But that took away my problem of what I was going to do to stay awake for the rest of the drive home because I had so much adrenaline going through my system. And it was one of those, aha, perspective, because that was, and even like the car, I was lucky the car behind me didn't have enough space, but was able to swerve into the lane beside him. So I didn't get rear-ended by the car behind me. It was just one of those like really, really near misses. And I felt very fortunate. I kind of felt like there was horseshoes dancing on my head. and then of course that made it hard for me to sleep because by the time I got home, I was just wired, overtired. And then with this shot of adrenaline. So I am in recovery mode today. And will be in recovery mode, every day this week, except Tuesday. If you do live in Atlanta, this podcast goes live after Tuesday. So I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing cause you'll miss it.
I was wondering if you'd done that math yet. I was like waiting.
I'm doing something really cool on Tuesday, and there's not enough time for me to tell Atlantans what I'm doing. hopefully you followed my social media and you saw that I was opening up the brand new Piedmont Sprouts and on Atlanta and Company in the morning. Hopefully you guys all saw that. I will hopefully have great footage to share from all of that. So if you didn't see it, I would suggest checking my social media sites because I probably shared holy smokes, here's me on TV. Because that, well, unless I bomb and then I'm not sharing it with anybody. And I'll like text Matt and be like, cut this out of the podcast. And he'll be like, nope, too late. It's already edited. So yeah, that's going to be on TV on Tuesday.
Super exciting.
Yes. And
I've never been to a Sprouts, so you'll have to tell me how that goes. I mean, I'm sure it'll be great, but.
They're really amazing stores. So if you live near Sprouts, I am phenomenally impressed. So I had one open up not even a month ago, very, very close to my house. And it is, I feel like it's a very health focused, but it sort of caters to a lot of different diets that are promoted for better health. So it caters to the Mediterranean diet as much as it caters to paleo, but it carries tons of neat paleo products. I mean, it also has crazy grains and other things. It's not like it's a paleo grocery store, but it has some really neat stuff, really good prices. I'm really impressed with their produce section and their bulk section. And they carry chameleon cold brew, which I was really excited about because my local Whole Foods doesn't. So it's definitely one of – now I've just added yet another grocery store to my rotation. I know it's like, I'll just go to all the grocery stores all the time, and that way I'll get all the food. I think that's my big plan. But
yeah,
I'm super excited to be partnering with Sprouts to help them launch their new store. And that's my big, and then I'm taking a break, everybody, because boy, do I need one. It'll be like 2 hours one day.
Well, like the experience of going from store to store to store to store was something that we totally did as well. And we put up the series in our blog about meal planning every week. Now we did one for the Healing Kitchen, but we do one every week. And that has been huge for us in terms of like focusing, because we know exactly what we need now and we don't go to as many stores as often. So
I think I go to three stores regularly, plus the farmer's market when the farmer's market is running. And for me, it's more that I've just developed my favorite, I have my favorite version of my favorite place that has my favorite this thing. And so what ends up happening is I have the couple of places I go the most frequently, and then the places where I have my favorite thing. So I have, like there's certain Trader Joe's products, for example, that I just really love, but I can get away with going to Trader Joe's every few weeks and kind of stocking up. So,
that's how we handle Trader Joe's and Costco.
Yeah. So, for me, it's not that I'm shopping for groceries every other day. But I do sort of have I know I need, these are the things on my list. I know I need, this and this, and I don't want to give up. Right. I don't want to get the second best version of whatever it is. So, so what I tend to do is sort of batch and sort of save it up when I know, okay, all of these things are great things that I can get at Sprouts, or all these things are great things that I can get at Whole Foods. And then I kind of do a targeted shopping, and there's lots of things that are good at all the stores. So then I round out with the things that are more general and I don't really care where I buy them. Oh, shopping. That wasn't what we were going to talk about.
No, we have a lot to talk about. And because we chatted so much earlier, maybe we should actually kind of jump in.
Yeah, maybe it's a good idea. So I was looking at some of the questions that have been submitted to the Paleo View lately, and I kind of hit on quite a few. Really, I kind of felt like there were general health questions that are fairly common questions. And I just kind of felt like it's Paleo FAQ. I feel like these are a little bit even more broader approach to paleo, broader health, broader, right? The idea of doing paleo for lifelong health rather than the autoimmune protocol type goals or weight loss goals. And I think we've, you know, we've done thematic shows about that before, and I'm sure we'll do them again because questions on those topics are always coming in. But I just kind of felt like, hey, wow, I've got this collection of questions here that I can sort of categorize as general health questions, but I think they kind of fit together as a show. So we're kind of doing, I think we'll call it common general health questions, something like that. So it's a little bit less focused than I think a lot of our shows are, but I think we're going to hit on some really great, you know, frequently thought about concepts within paleo, not just for newbies, but for people who have been doing this for a while. So I think it's going to be cool. I mean, if I didn't think it would be cool, we wouldn't be doing it. So there's always that.
Either it's cool or you're kind. That's the way.
Right. But I also have some science I want to talk about first.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So I love the fact that we record our podcast and that we don't have this huge delay between when we record and when our podcasts go live. So I know that other podcasts, they might batch record, you know, 20 in a couple of weeks, and then those podcasts trickle out over months. Or people will pre-record with 2-3 weeks in advance, so that they can get full transcripts done. And it's one of the reasons why we don't get full transcripts done is because, first of all, we think our show notes are amazing. And second of all, because we really prefer to have this short period of time between when we record and when the podcast goes live so that we can be really current, which normally we're really current in news and views. But today I want to be really current in Science with Sarah. And it's because this new paper came out. I actually just read it on Friday. The paper is not even 2 weeks old, and it is probably the most depressing scientific paper I've ever read, but incredibly actionable and something that I think is information that everyone needs to know. So I wanted to share that with you today in Science with Sarah. So the paper was published in Nature, which is arguably the most prestigious scientific journal. It is definitely, science is also extremely prestigious. Nature tends to do more of the medical stuff and science tends to do more technology. But those are like the two journals that meet. Once you get one paper in those journals, your scientific career is made. They are incredibly hard to get your work into. Your work has to be earth-shatteringly important and incredibly rigorous in order to make it into those journals. And this paper was called Diet-Induced Extinctions in the Gut Microbiota Compound Over Generations, which for some people, they would be like, what? For me, I was like, holy moly, like, let me find somebody who can get me the full version of this paper so I don't spend $200. I read the entire paper nearly in tears. So what the researchers did is they asked actually a really simple question, which was, what happens to the gut microbiome when we go on a low-fiber diet? And they were really looking at, you know, their analogy was the standard American diet is a low-fiber diet, right? As foods get more processed and refined, as the amount of fast food that we eat increases. These are all foods that, you know, the more you process and refine a food, the more nutrients and fiber are taken out of that food. And the typical Western diet now is lower fiber than it's ever been, ever. And so they were looking at that, but it's not the only low fiber diet. And I'll get to that in a second. But that was the broader impact that these authors were considering. So they were asking, what happens to the gut microbiome when we go on this low fiber diet? Are those changes reversible? And if not, what happens over subsequent generations? Because we know that we largely inherit our parents' microbiomes. The microbiome is, and I've talked about this on the show before, but let's just have a quick little summary session here. The gut microbiome refers to the collection of microbes that are living in our digestive tracts. This is mostly bacteria, but there are other types of, you know, viruses, bacteria, yeast, other types of single cell organisms that live in our digestive tracts. We know that we have at least as many cells in our guts as we have cells in our body, if not about double. And that's kind of new science, actually, too. We used to say there was 10 times as many cells living in our digestive tracts as cells in our bodies, but that's actually an over approximation. And we have a completely codependent symbiotic relationship with these bacteria. So the thing that we give them is a home and food. And the thing that they give us is invaluable and irreplaceable health benefits, period. They help us digest our food. They help us access nutrients from our food. They create nutrients from our food for us to absorb. They regulate the immune system. They regulate our metabolism. They regulate our gut barriers. They regulate our neurotransmitters. They impact every system in our bodies because they impact things like hormones, cytokines, and neurotransmitters. So they produce a ton of chemical messengers that get into our blood and can influence everything from brain health to skin health to immune health. And so one of the things that we know is that a healthy gut microbiome is a necessary condition for overall health, and that every chronic illness in which we've looked to see if there's something happening with the gut microbiome, we've found that, yes, there is. There's some kind of dysbiosis, some kind of wrong kind of bacteria growing in the wrong numbers, in the wrong places in the gut, and that's linked to disease and typically is a precondition for the disease. So you cannot develop, for example, certain autoimmune diseases unless you have gut dysbiosis first. And that's actually been discovered in every single autoimmune disease in which it has been investigated so far. So the other thing that we know about the gut microbiome is that what makes a healthy gut microbiome is a highly varied one. So the more variety and different types of species that we have in our gut bacteria, the better. There's something like 35,000 different microbes that can live in the human gut across all humans in the world. Each one of us has something like 500 to 1,000 different species. And we know that it's far better to be on the 1,000 end of that spectrum, if not even more, compared to the 500 end of the spectrum. And the way that we do that is by eating a fiber-rich diet. So what bacteria generally eat is fiber, and they eat different bacteria, different microbes prefer different types of fiber. So the best way to do that is to consume, for us, a very wide range of veggies and fruit, things like nuts and seeds as well, and focusing on big portions of especially non-starchy vegetables for their fiber, and as much variety as possible. We know that too high of fat can mess with the type of bacteria that like to grow in our body. And we know that long chain omega-3 fats, so DHA and EPA from seafood, is incredibly important for the health of our gut microbiomes. So that's where our diet fits in with what we know is a healthy microbiome. So how does this low fiber diet, you know, if we're not providing the food for our bacteria, how does that affect the bacteria? So what this study did was it used what's called humanized mice. So these are mice with a human microbiome, and they divided the mice into two groups. They fed one group a diet that was rich in a diversity of vegetable-derived fibers, and they fed the other group a low-fiber diet mimicking the fiber content of a standard American diet that's sort of rich in fast food. And then what they did was they used genetic sequencing to quantify the amount of bacteria from 200 different species of bacteria, or 208, it was a little bit over 200, in their poop. And the reason why they did this particular few hundred different species of bacteria is because they were the ones that had the most reliable gene sequences. So it was reliability of our ability to measure them. So after 4 weeks on the low-fiber diet, there was a 60% drop in the diversity of the gut bacteria. So there was only 40% left of the number of different species after just 4 weeks on this low-fiber diet in these mice. But this is where things start to get depressing and made me fight back tears while I was reading this on the plane. After 7 weeks of going back on a high-fiber diet, only half of the lost species came back. So there was still a 30% reduction, or it's actually a little bit more, 33% reduction in the number of species after 7 weeks, which is a very long time in a mouse's life, of these species that that had come back. And so then what the researchers did, which just compounds the depression aspect of this paper, was that they then started looking at what happens over generations. And they had a huge variety of different experiments to test this. They ended up going over for 4 generations, and they looked at if the mice were weaned onto a low fiber diet versus weaned onto a high fiber diet versus, right. And then they kept doing the low fiber diet for 4 weeks and switched back to the high fiber diet for 7 weeks. But basically what they saw was this progressive decline in the number of species that could come back after the return to a high fiber diet with each generation. So the mice are inheriting this less diverse microbiome. So even when they go on the high fiber diet, they weren't exposed. There wasn't this inoculation with that same diversity of bacteria. So they can't return to the microbiome of a mouse that never went on a low fiber diet. And by 4 generations, 72% of the bacterial diversity was irreversibly lost in these mice. And so what this paper was really trying to emphasize was that if we don't fix the food system fast, we're not going to be able to recover human health because of how inextricably linked our health is with this diversity of the gut microbiome. And when we're talking about loss of bacterial diversity, we're talking about bacterial extinction. I mean, yes, it's extinction of one person, but we're talking about an entire society that's eating this way. You end up with entire groups of people who are losing these bacteria, and then we if we're not even living in proximity with people with those bacteria, there's like no mechanism for exposure. And in fact, the researchers showed that the only treatment, probiotic treatment, was not sufficient. The only treatment that allowed the full return of the microbiome diversity was a fecal microbiota transplant, or an FMT. And that is certainly a procedure that is available for humans, but it's not an easy one to get right now. It's only approved for certain situations like Clostridium difficile, I think. And so a lot of people who want FMTs are actually going out of country in order to get them. And so if we get to the point where our only mechanism of reversing the tide of disease in Western societies is getting poop from rural places around the world that haven't ever been exposed to these types of disease, and like doing fecal microbiota transplants en masse, like that to me is the beginning of a teen romance dystopic future novel, which I would totally read. But I don't think that's a good place that we want to go as a society.
I don't think teens would really want to read that either.
True that. All right. It would have to be like, there would have to be some heavy sci-fi aspect where it was masked and people didn't know what was really going on. And then they find out at the end, it's the plot twist. Oh my gosh, it's poop. Right. Then Matt Damon could be in the movie. No. Okay. So one of the things I want to emphasize here is, even though the paper was talking about a standard American diet, a fast food centered diet, those aren't the only low fiber diets out there that are causing this loss of bacterial diversity in our guts. So a low carb diet is almost always also a low fiber diet, and a ketogenic diet is 99.9999% of the time a low fiber diet. And when you combine that those are high fat diets, and high fat above about 60% fat has also been shown to cause gut dysbiosis and encourage the growth of pathogenic species of bacteria. Now we're talking about something that is relatively embraced, or at least accepted, within the paleo movement. Although I've talked on the show before that I don't believe that's correct. But we're talking about things that, nobody's talking about how that could affect the gut microbiome. Well, I'm talking about it now. I really believe that even within the paleo movement, we need to be focusing on higher vegetable consumption. And it's one of my, you know, Stacey's hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I've been using hashtag 3/4 veggies. These are concepts that need to get more traction within the community because we're not just, with vegetables, we're not just worried about fiber. It's amazing, right? Best source of fiber we can get is vegetables. But vegetables also have really bioavailable minerals, tons of vitamins, and also phytochemicals, which have incredibly diverse full body health benefits. So there's zero downside to lots of veggies. And I would like to encourage everybody, especially in the light of this new study, to work on increasing our vegetable consumption. So the question, of course, is going to be like, well, how much? How much? And I'm going to answer that. I was going to say I'm going to leave that to the Q&A, but then I realized I should probably answer it right now. So the daily recommended allowance of fiber is 25 grams. And I would challenge people to actually track their fiber intake and see if they're hitting 25 grams. It actually takes a lot of vegetable intake to get to 25 grams. Studies of hunter-gatherers show usual consumption between 50 grams and 200 grams daily of fiber. And so my recommendation is to aim for something like 9 to 14 servings of vegetables a day, a mix of starchy and non-starchy vegetables. And actually, I recommend using a food journal or an app like Chronometer. Does MyFitnessPal track fiber, Stacey?
It does, but the problem is that some of the foods that you might choose, if they don't put in the fiber, so like if someone creates a recipe, and I'm using the quotation marks here, and they don't select the authorized carrot or the, like, there's little verified check mark next to things, and those are the actual true things that have all nutrients. So if someone creates something and it doesn't have all the verified things, then it's not going to have, I find very often, that micronutrients are missing from a lot of foods and only macronutrients. So when I look at my picture for the day, it's really giving me representation of like 50% if I'm not, you know, if I'm not inputting everything myself, if I'm just grabbing from certain things. So be careful if you are using MyFitnessPal, because at first I was like, oh my gosh, why is my calcium and my fiber and my vitamin A so low? I know that I ate, you know, spinach and kale or, you know, like whatever it is. And then I realized that it was because those foods weren't input correctly.
Chronometer will also have, it draws on a couple of different databases, but it has the entire USDA database in it. And when you see, instead of like a little verified check, it'll say that that's the nutrients that comes from USDA. It's selection of, I think the more high quality paleo foods is a little bit more limited, but it does have some grass-fed meat in there that is seems pretty accurate in terms of the micronutrients. So, and Chronometer is what I use to track my micronutrient intake. I really recommend, I like food journaling. To me, it is very, very helpful to just have that level of awareness. I know that doesn't work for everybody, but I do recommend taking a journal for a couple of days just to see if you're close to on track with fiber intake. I think it's really, really important. I think, you know, we call fiber a non-essential nutrient, and I think that's a mistake. You know, just because we won't die if we don't eat it for a while, I think it's very, very clear that it can, if we don't eat it for a while, it damages our health in a way that is incredibly difficult to recover from. So, eat more vegetables. Look for sources of probiotics for re-inoculation. Don't regret the things that you've done in the past. I followed a low carbohydrate diet for a very long time. I know that I have that to recover from. I also have been, I was a very sickly child and I was on antibiotics an average of 10 times a year growing up. So I have that to recover from. There's similar studies showing that once you're on antibiotics, once there are species in the microbiome that are lost that never come back. So we all have these challenges. The point is not to regret what we didn't know before, but to let it inform our choices moving forward. That was a lot of science.
I'm glad you covered the antibiotic portion at the end, because I was kind of curious if that had come into play. So, awesome. We can answer a few questions.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our first question is from Mary, and I put it as our first question because I knew I was going to talk about fiber and the science. So her first question was, how much fiber do we need to be healthy? And I've already answered that, which is sort of a bare minimum of 25 grams, 50 to 200 grams mimics what hunter-gatherers eat. But the next part of her question is, can you overdo fiber? Which I think is worth discussing. Generally, the answer is no, but there's a big but that comes at the end of that sentence. So bacteria help us break down fiber. They ferment fiber that then they go through their life cycle that creates the bulk that is our stool. Our stool is about 80% made up of dead bacteria. And when we don't have the right type of bacteria to help us break down that fiber, it can cause gastrointestinal symptoms. And that can vary from diarrhea, constipation, bloating, distension, and it can or undigested food particles, right? So just inefficient digestion. And that can be very frustrating. It's something that it can happen for people as they're gradually trying to increase their fiber intake. It also happens, we see this in these dietary strategies designed for SIBO that have a starve the gut bacteria. So GAPS, SCD, low FODMAPs, all of those strategies are designed to be short-term interventions. And they're not actually at all a good idea for long-term. Because what happens is when you starve everything by cutting out fermentable fibers, but then you don't have anything for the good guys to grow. And the best thing you can do to keep the bad guys in check is have lots of good guys around. So those strategies work really well for the 2 to 4 week time frame. Afterwards, it becomes really important to gradually increase fiber intake. And when people are having symptoms, it's some of the strategies that we take is one is pull back, increase slower. So if you have to pull back to, you know, if you went on a low FODMAP diet and you're trying to reintroduce FODMAPs, you might have to start at like a teaspoon of a sweet potato a day. So you do it to tolerance. So if you're getting symptoms, pull back and then slowly increase until you're at a full portion size. And so we can do that even in the context of going from a diet that just never really had fiber on its radar to, okay, now I'm going to try and get 50 grams a day. And the reason for that is a lot of the good bacteria that we're trying to grow with a high fiber diet that we know are so important for health are slow growers. And so they're slow growers and they're going to help us digest all this extra fiber. So it can be very overwhelming for our systems to go from a low fiber diet to a high fiber diet right away. So easing into it and monitoring GI symptoms, pulling back when GI symptoms appear or are severe. I mean, if they're mild and it's not intruding in your life, then and you don't have overt health problems, I don't see that as being a big deal. Just if they're very mild, but if they are intrusive symptoms, pull back a little bit and start working on going up more slowly and also working on more foods that are going to help inoculate the gut. So fermented foods. Things like playing in the dirt, finding locally grown organic vegetables and not washing the dirt. I mean, washing the big bits of dirt off, but not washing the little bits of dirt off. Those are great sources of different types of probiotics. And is there a cap? I mean, when I look at hunter-gatherers eating 200 grams of fiber a day and what I would have to do in my life to get 200 grams of fiber, like... I guess 200 grams is a cap if that's what we see in hunter-gatherers, but it's not something that I think anybody eating out of a Western food supply is going to have to worry about.
Okay.
Yeah, I just totally railroaded that question, didn't I?
I got nothing. Next.
This question is from Glenda. What are the best numbers to pay attention to for general health? Are there questions I should be asking my doctor during my yearly physical?
So, it really depends on your doctor, first of all. Let me just say that I've had doctors that run tests and don't look into things or interpret things differently than other doctors. Some doctors don't even run the same tests. So I think it's important for me, I would recommend that you know ahead of time what it is that you're looking to gain from your yearly physical, and ask for those things. Some practitioners might say they can't give them to you, but for the most part, if you say, and we've talked, for example, before about specifically what to look for on a thyroid test, for example, you can go back to our Hashi show and look at that, right? So if you know that you think you might have some sort of condition and you want a full panel on something, know that ahead of time. And they might say, well, let's run, you know, your regular numbers and then see how it comes back. If it looks a little iffy, then we can do a full panel. Or some doctors right away can say, okay, yeah, great. Let me run that. I'll say that I ended up finding a doctor locally different from the doctor that I'd had before I was paleo and all that kind of stuff, who, you know, looked into, for example, not just my total glucose, my total cholesterol numbers, but when they ran their panel, they did triglycerides in addition to the H. Oh, goodness, I really should have Googled and reminded myself before we did the show. But the good cholesterol, the bad cholesterol. Remind me, Sarah. What are the...
HDL's good, LDL's bad.
Yeah, I remembered H. I couldn't remember the other one. Anyway, but the triglycerides was most important for me because that's an indicator of the kind of fats and the sugars and the way that your body's processing things. So for me, you know, it was great to see that breakdown as on just a first pass. So blood sugar is another one that I think is really good. If they can give you a detailed information on, that was really helpful for me to see, the different ways, not just your, AC1, which is also returned, but you can get more in depth on a lot of those different kinds of things. So I think it's just a matter of who you are and what you're interested in finding out. For me, I was like, give me the world, whatever kind of in-depth panel you can give it back. And because I have, you know, a history of morbid obesity and I'm still overweight, it's pretty easy to justify, hey, we want to look into all these different things. And so they're able to get that full panel put through. So maybe you could answer the specific question she should ask.
I mean, I think that the numbers that a regular physician will look at and care about, like HDL, LDL, cholesterol, hemoglobin A1C, fasting blood glucose, fasting insulin, general thyroid numbers, vitamin D, C-reactive protein, you know, looking at a CBC differential, that's a complete blood cell count. Differential. So it tells you the different types of cells. I mean, those are all really good measurements. Like medicine's awesome. I don't see why we have to be so, I totally see why we have to be so jaded, but, it doesn't mean we throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that being a little bit more educated about reference ranges, because a lot of what a doctor will say is fine is not fine. And sometimes, especially when it comes to cholesterol, what a doctor will say is a problem is not a problem. So, for example, if your total cholesterol is a tiny bit high, but it's because your HDL is through the roof and your triglycerides are really low, that's amazing. But a doctor might say, oh, well, your total cholesterol is high. We need to work on that. But, you know, if your total cholesterol is high because your LDL is high and your triglycerides are, you know, even moderate, that's definitely time to make some changes. So I think that all those numbers that, you know, blood pressure that a doctor would look at in a general physical, they're all informative. And they're all the numbers that are used. They're all the sort of, it's what we have available as quantifiable health measures. Now, if you think that you've got a problem with a certain, you know, system, endocrine system like thyroid, you know, that's where requesting more detailed testing is definitely useful. But if it just comes to like just monitoring how things are going, the usual stuff I think is really great. I would definitely suggest making sure your doctor's putting vitamin D on your yearly blood work. About 75% of us are deficient in vitamin D, and that has a really huge impact on just about everything about us. And supplementing with vitamin D is like crazy effective and straightforward. The only thing is you need to do follow-ups. When you start supplementing vitamin D, you need to follow up and make sure that your vitamin D is getting into a good range. Being too high in vitamin D is also problematic. So that's one that isn't always included, and I think should be. Other than that, I mean, any other questions I think would be specific to symptoms or specific health concerns. I think from a general health and wellness perspective, I think what a doctor is normally looking at for a yearly physical is actually a pretty good set of measurements. I just like pissed a bunch of people off with that.
Well, I can say even before I knew what I was looking for, and I know this because I ended up comparing later results to earlier results, I did get things that would have been helpful for me to know about had I known, like if I had been more educated about the results. I just found that the doctor that I was seeing wasn't very educated. So like my thyroid numbers didn't look great. My white blood cell count, that was the thing I was going to say, right? Like they were running that and it was coming up as a major problem, but it wasn't like discussed or identified as, hey, this could be a symptom of like X, Y, or Z. It was, this doesn't look great. You should see a blood specialist. And that scared me. And I just did nothing with that information. I can't hear you.
I think it's always good to ask for a copy of your numbers so that you have that copy. And that way, you can have a look at Institute for Functional Medicine is a great resource, and have a look at what, right? There's reference ranges, which are based on what is average. They call it normal, but it's not, right? It's average of a very sick population. So then there's some research that is starting to define a tighter range that is more optimal. So for example, I might have these numbers wrong, but I think it's an A1C, which measures spikes in blood sugar levels, but like as an average over the last about 6 weeks. So it kind of tells you how your blood sugar has been doing over time, as opposed to your current blood sugar level, which is right now, or your insulin level, which is a little bit more, right? Just what's right now. So it gives you a really good, like what has been happening for the last little while. And I think that what's considered normal is under 5.5, but what's considered optimal is under 4.5. So being able to look at those numbers and know, even if your doctor says they're fine, know whether or not they suggest that some tweaking would be good. It's really helpful to have that number in front of you. And just remember that when you take those numbers and Google it, that 80% of the internet is BS. Just remember that.
Yeah. I was going to say, be careful when you Google medical things, because you're going to feel like you have all the things when you're done Googling whatever it is you're looking for.
I mean, I think it's really great to empower ourselves with knowledge. It's just, please remember, for most of the people out there, that a lot of stuff that looks like knowledge on the internet is not actually. It's more like,
yeah, look into the credentials and the type of comments that are like, it just, you know, think about where you are. That's all. Just okay. We got stuff.
Yes.
I'm gonna keep going.
This question is from Kimberly. I've been following paleo for about a month now, and so far I'm really enjoying it. I'm just worried about the amount of protein, fat, and carbs. My friend who started me on paleo said to just eat as much as I want to of all the yes foods. Are there some general guidelines to follow? There is so much info out there. I would love to hear your thoughts.
So the general guidelines that I can give I'm not going to tell you what's out there because you can go to different places and you'll hear a bajillion different things. Let me just tell you.
It's all out there.
Yeah. Let me just tell you the guidelines I follow. How about that? I value nutrients. I try to focus on where I'm going to get my nutrients for the day because I do plan my day calorically and macro to help me maintain my health from both not having a gallbladder, from having thyroid disease, and from not being as physically active as I have been because of an injury over the last 6 months. So those things cause me to be mindful of both the micro and macronutrients that I put into my person. So I am aware, I kind of think ahead of the day, like, do I have some thing that I want to do today? For example, I knew that I was going to brunch earlier this weekend and I wanted to order the gluten-free breakfast pizza, which is pretty much devoid of anything other than just like bacon and cheese and gluten-free pizza dough. So I knew that I would have to eat vegetables at other points in the day. And so I planned around having a dinner of like basically 100% green things with then lamb meatballs on top, which lamb is a good omega-3 fat for me. So when I say I value nutrients, that means that I focus on where I'm going to get my nutrient-dense foods at the most opportunities that I can. I think about making sure that I get organ meats a couple times a week. And lately, that's been super easy with Epic's liver bites. Sarah, are you as obsessed with those as I am?
Yes.
Okay. All right. There was a long mute there, and I was like,
So they have black pepper in them. Okay. Which means they're not autoimmune protocol. And black pepper was on my food sensitivity panel. And they have a lot of black pepper in them. So yeah. I actually don't personally do very well with them, but I love the idea of them. I do think they're very tasty. They just don't work for me or AIPers. And that I think is sad.
That's fair. Black pepper is not something that bothers me, so I forget that it is AIP because it's not a nightshade. So
it's a seed, but it's interestingly enough, so it's a berry spice, but berry spices that incorporates the seed. And interestingly enough, it is one of the most common spice food intolerances.
I could see that. I could definitely
so crazy high in phytoestrogens. Yeah. Just throwing that one out there too.
So. My point was, I think about making sure that I get organ meats a couple times a week. I make sure that I get seafood a couple times a week, and I make sure that I get broth a couple times a week. These are the things that I think, like at the beginning of the week, when we make our meal plan, I usually put seafood into the dinner once a week, and then I make sure that I have seafood in the form of like tuna salad or salmon salad, or I order oysters if we eat out, things like that. Twice a week as well. And then I have broth. If I don't incorporate it into like soups or other things that I'm consuming, then I just have mugs of it throughout the week. So for me, there are things that I personally prioritize because I'm working on healing and maintaining my health. When I started paleo, all of those things would have been really overwhelming for me. So when you're kind of a month into paleo and you say like, I'm overwhelmed at, you know, what are the yes paleo foods and the general guidelines? A little more simplistic way to think of that is this like the most healthy thing that I can eat, or is this a food that tastes good? And that's kind of how I phrase it with my kids, right? So we get mixed nuts, and there's absolutely nothing wrong for mixed nuts, especially for, you know, active kids. It is a great source of dense energy for them. But if you are a person who is trying to lose weight and you sit down and you have a literal Costco-sized container of nuts and you're reaching in and you're grabbing it and popping it into your mouth the way that you would popcorn, you're going to consume a lot more omega-6 fatty acids, which can lead to inflammation. You're going to consume a lot more calories than you necessarily intended. And for a lot of people who have, you know, a nut intolerance, you can also make yourself sick. So there are some foods where, you know, for me, in the beginning, I think just prioritizing healthy meats and vegetables and thinking of those as your core food groups are just really important. And then, you know, you can have fruits, but they're not a core food group. And you can have, of course, healthy fats, but it's not a core food group. Like, the most important thing from my perspective is really getting in the habit of eating meat and vegetables, because that's really what we try to prioritize in paleo.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think that in paleo, there's this tendency to go towards the extreme. So people tend to either identify as a safe starcher who eats really high carb, or a low carber who eats really high fat. When we actually look at hunter-gatherers, they generally fall in this thing called moderation, which, it, you know, that everything in moderation is like one of those phrases that I have strongly detested for so long. So it always feels weird when I suggest it. But if you look at hunter-gatherers, their ranges for macronutrients fall in the 20 to 35% protein, 25 to 40% carbs, and like 30 to 50-55% fat. And most of them fall in that like 30-30-40, 35-35, like kind of this like a little bit of everything kind of place. And as a like practical, from a practical implementation standpoint, to be 35 you know, it doesn't really matter which one's protein, which one's carbs, which one's fat, right? If you're getting a third, or, you know, one's a little bit higher, and maybe one day your protein will be a bit higher, and another your carbs will be a bit higher, another day your fat will be a bit higher. But the way that generally looks is about a quarter of your plate being a protein, and maybe one starchy vegetable, a moderate portion of one starchy vegetable, and a couple of non-starchy vegetables, maybe a piece of fruit or two in the day. And it generally is not like, generally if you can hit 30 to 40% of your calories from fat really easily without added fat, like just having the natural fat content in meat and seafood. Maybe you sauteed some vegetables in some fat, or roasted some vegetables in some fat. You don't have to drench things with sauces and butter and dressing to hit, you know, 30 to 40% fat. So,
I will say that I eat a higher fat than like you're mentioning and that you've recommended on previous shows. And it's just like how I eat. I don't add things to foods and stuff. It's just like naturally when I put the foods on my plate and I feel satiated and I'm focusing on vegetables, like that's how I, that's just where I end up. And for me, it's like salami is one of the things that I eat a lot of. That is, and eggs, they're crazy high in fat, yeah, without like, is, you know, without not, adding fat to anything.
Right. It is not hard. So if you look at the highest fat range in hunter-gatherers of about 55%, it is not hard to get there from the natural fat content in foods. I mean, especially if you're eating something like avocado or olives, or fattier cuts of meat, like you go there really fast without, you know, drenching things in butter or ghee or lard or whatever. So, so that, I mean, that's what we see is actually, you know, probably a lower fat than most people typically find themselves eating on paleo. And, again, you know, I think that's really, a really important concept to keep in mind that, you know, if the whole idea is to emulate hunter-gatherers and Paleolithic man, then, you know, we can't just emulate one of the two tribes that ate either really high fat or really high carb. Like, there's the few dozen, you know, well-studied ones in the middle that are actually that show us that that's actually what the vast majority of humans are well adapted to. But it is interesting to note that there are exceptions, and there are hunter-gatherer populations that eat much higher fat or that eat much higher carb and much lower protein. And probably, going back to Stacy's point on this question, is probably macronutrients matter a lot less than micronutrients when it comes to our health. And probably if we're getting the full complement and diversity of micronutrients, we can probably tolerate a huge range of different macronutrients. So in that sense, Kimberly's friend is right. But I think that, again, you know, keeping a food journal and being mindful, making sure your caloric intake is not through the roof, because as much as weight, you know, being a healthy weight is more complicated than calories in and calories out, calories are still a thing that actually matter. So, you know, one of the things that I think the majority of people will find that their caloric intake just naturally decreases on paleo. But there is the other experience where people go really nuts on nuts. See what I did there?
I mean, when you're going nuts on nuts and you're putting butter in your coffee and, you know, you're adding avocados to everything because you hear that this is the thing to do with paleo, then, like, before you know it, you've just added 2,000 to 4,000 calories to a natural diet that you wouldn't necessarily have done otherwise. So it's just, it's about what your goals are and what you're into. Like, I know that people want more information than that, but
there's a lot. I think we gave some excellent starting points and food for thought.
Yes. So I have gotten this question a few times, and while we're on the topic, I'm just going to address it because I haven't chimed in when you've given macronutrient recommendations before. And I did talk about changing up my macros when I stopped lifting so much. So I will say that I have been doing this ratio for over 2 months now. I am currently at 50% fat, 30% protein, 20% carbohydrates as my goals. Sometimes I fluctuate with the fat and the carbs, but I try to always keep the protein. I get added protein from broth and collagen from Vital Protein. So it's usually about 20 to 25% max from food. And then I'm getting additional collagen as that extra 5%. I find that this has worked really well for me. I was having, I was getting into some thyroid flare issues a couple of months ago from specifically stress and inflammation. I talked on the show about how I was focusing on bringing down inflammation and had kind of quit sugar and alcohol and things like that in order to help, and went more strictly AIP as well as incorporated this macro. I can say that it is difficult to get in enough vegetables without kind of going over carbohydrates if I'm doing a lot of starchy vegetables, if I'm doing things like gluten-free pizza. So honestly, this macro has really helped me focus on making sure that I'm getting those vegetables, because I know that if I, you know, futz around with some of the foods that aren't the best yes foods, so to speak, then it really does affect what I'm trying to achieve. And so I have had great results. I haven't had any issues with digestion and the gallbladder and all that kind of stuff. I thought that going this high fat, I would have that problem, but I haven't. And I've also lost a few pounds, which is great. So I will just say that, you know, a lot of people have asked. I do post most of the foods that I eat. I don't always put on, like, what I drink, a cup of broth and stuff like that, into MyFitnessPal, but that is available if people are interested, because I know as you're starting out, trying to figure out, like, what to eat when and how much of this and all that kind of stuff can feel overwhelming. So it's why Sarah and I put, you know, our plates out there and our lives out there so that people can at least see, okay, this is what they're eating. And not all of us can eat, you know, 3/4 of a plate of dry greens, Sarah. So we just try as we might. We can't all be there.
I do really enjoy plain lettuce, but I did not have plain lettuce with any of my meals today. So there you go. I'm actually not that far from you. So I'm at about, my target is 30, 40. But what I target is 30% protein, and then I don't care if which one of my fat or carbs. Yeah,
exactly. That's much more my priority.
So I'm counting, the things I'm counting is I try to hit all my micronutrient targets for the day. So I try to hit the recommended daily allowance of everything, including my 25 grams of fiber. And I do the same thing that you do. So I probably have one serving of something starchy during the day, and it's a moderate sized serving, and everything else is non-starchy. It's been working really well for me. I've been doing this for a little over a month, and I've also lost some weight. And I think for me, it's, one of the biggest things has just been the act of journaling my food. I talked about this on our New Year's resolution show, that was my one and only New Year's resolution this year, was to write down, was to keep track of everything I'm eating, to just have that awareness, so that I'm not eating reflexively. And that doesn't mean I don't have high days. I don't have days where I'm like, all right, I'm going to eat this treat, but I write down that I eat that treat. And then it becomes more of a thought out decision, and rather than a compulsion. I really am just looking at, you know, my goal for the day is to hit my micronutrient targets. I'm hitting all my vitamins and minerals and fiber. And about 30% protein. And then also trying to maintain a fairly small caloric deficit. Problem with big caloric deficits is they can mess with your hormones and make weight loss maintenance incredibly difficult. So it's a very moderate long game. But it's been really fantastic for my energy levels, really fantastic for my sleep quality, and really fantastic for my mental obsession with food. For some reason, being more thoughtful about what I'm eating is making me think about food less. Isn't that weird?
It's the same way with me, honestly, because we have talked before about emotional eating in the past, and making it a math equation, which is essentially what I'm doing, removes the emotion out of it and creates like a different kind of obsession for my brain. I'm not sure if that's necessarily like healthy to not walk away from the obsession entirely, but it's a step in the right direction for sure. And it allows me to focus my energy about food on something other than, you know, the emotions and that kind of stuff. And because I know that I'm tracking, it makes me more mindful of, I'm not just going to, you know, have this emotional binge that I really want to have. You know, it's okay for me to, you know, enjoy this thing that, you know, if I want to treat myself, or, you know, I'm in a social situation, I know what my boundaries are, because it's a math equation. And can I balance out that math equation later or not? And do I care today if my math doesn't come out perfect? And it's a much different thought process than shame or guilt or frustration or sadness taking over and making those decisions.
I love it. So I think we could probably answer a question, these types of general questions, for hours. Maybe what we'll do is we'll put together another podcast with similar general health questions for the not too distant future. But I think we should wrap it up. Do you have any, we had a pretty good news and views section. I feel like we've done. Is there anything we've been missing? Oh, I know what I missed. The next
thing in the show where you're like, hey, Stacy, I'm giving you this opportunity to talk. No, just kidding.
I would love to shut my mouth and let you talk right now, if that's what you're telling me you'd like to do.
No, I'm just taking the opportunity to call you out. That's all. Go ahead.
Yeah, I did just do that. So what just happened right there was I was thinking while I was talking, and then I had an idea, and so then I ran with it.
I got you. Go ahead.
So the next Go to Bed group challenge, which is hosted by the Go to Bed Facebook and Instagram pages, starts this Sunday. And if you're not familiar with that, I highly recommend going back and listening to our Go to Bed episode from a few weeks ago, when the Go to Bed online program launched. But the feedback from this program has been phenomenal. People are seeing amazing health results with these really small tweaks to focus on improved sleep. And I've had so many people tell me they can't believe that this amount of information is coming in an ebook, that it like that nobody puts together ebooks with this level of crazy stuff in it. The reason why it's an ebook is because, and not a print book, is simply because the scientific research on sleep is spiking right now, and I really needed the mechanism of being able to update to reflect that information as it came in. And I already have updated the book. There's another update coming. Once you buy it once, you will always get all of the updates for free. So you can find out more information at thepaleomom.com/go-to-bed and get yourself a pair of amber tinted glasses so you can start the next group challenge on Sunday. It's pretty awesome. Sleep does great things.
The answer to your question is no. I don't believe that I have anything else to add. I want to encourage everyone to join in Handstand Month. Sarah got inverted this week.
I did. I did a headstand. I couldn't get a handstand. I found the pressure on my wrist was really intense.
Interesting.
I was able to get into a headstand a couple of times.
I don't like headstands because of pressure on my neck. But, well, you know, to each their own.
So, I think I was getting a lot of pressure on my hands. So it was like this fine balance of my head was taking enough so that it wasn't too bad on my wrist. My arms were taking enough so that it wasn't too bad on my neck. It worked for me is what I'm saying. And I will continue to work on my handstands. But I had one way of getting upside down and holding it for a little while. So that was cool for me.
So my point is that it's a lot of fun and it is happening. Like a ton of people are doing it and telling me that they're excited and doing things for the first time because they've been inspired. So join us. It is super fun to do things with other people versus all by yourself. Yeah. And we have been periscoping, which is weird. We've been blogging new recipes. So make sure that you're signed up for all the things and stuff, all the social medias and all of the newsletter links, all that kind of stuff will be in the show notes. But of course you can subscribe on both directly, Sarah and I's blog, thepaleomom.com and paleoparents.com. Thank you to everyone that voted in Paleo Magazine Best of 2015. Honestly, it was an honor just to be nominated, and I'm sure Sarah, you can say the same thing. So
I agree.
I want to thank everyone for doing that. And just as a last reminder, if you haven't yet, or it's been a while, if you could leave us a review in however it is that you're listening, it would be much appreciated and help other listeners be encouraged to find the show.
And thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.